Okay, so thank you very much to the organizer for the invitation, for the possibility to speak about this topic that I really like. And so what happened is that during this workshop, sometimes you heard this word, A theorem. I can prove things, I can say something non-perturbatively. So the idea of this talk should be to actually to give an idea of how these things works. In perturbation theory and in supersymmetry. Okay, so I will just introduce my this topic, try to give you the main ideas, and my motivation will come afterwards, so it will be much easier. And I will talk about mainly how you can use these properties of these quantities to constrain a fixed point in perturbation theory and beyond if you have supersymmetry. And these are the two works where I actually we spell this out, and we work a little bit some example of this application. And I will conclude with some conclusions. Okay, so the basic setup is actually first thing that I would like to define is what it is an energy flow. So an energy flow is simply can be described by two CFTs, ultraviolet CFT and an infrared CFT, and they're connected by a flow generated by an operator belonging to the CFT UV. So in this case, you see a sketch of how this flow should happen. And this plane stands for the fact that now I'm talking about CFT in flat space. Okay, so this is an RG flow between two CFT defined in flat space. And you know that conformality is broken at the with a trace anomaly. And this anomaly is an operatorial one. So it means that proportional to the operators in the CFT UV. And the trace of the stress energy momentum tensor is exactly the smoking gun that says when the conformality is broken. And as you can see, it is restored at the fixed point where beta functions are zero. Okay. So now let's just change a little bit this framework and consider the same CFTs, but on a curved background, okay? What happens here is that I can have my flow as before. The only thing is that the trace of the energy momentum tensor will pick up an anomaly, which is not an operatorial anomaly, it's proportional to the identity, so it's just a C number, okay? And as long as the gravity, so the background is not quantized, this is innocuous, okay? And I would like now to talk about actually this anomaly. So a first thing is that you can prove that if you have a CFT in flat space, you can extend it to a curved background in a diff times vial invariant way, okay, classically. So that's something you can do. The example is the free boson, where you couple it with an R, with a non-minimal coupling to the background such that you can have vial invariants. And the point is that, however, you will pick up an anomaly. So the general shape of this anomaly in D equal 4 consists of two pieces. So the first one is proportional to the vial tensor squared, which is the only tensor which is conformally invariant in four dimension, and the Gauss-Bonnet term that we heard today, which is a topological term. So is actually proportional to the Euler characteristic of the manifold you consider. Okay, and one thing that also we should point out is that these anomalies, they kind of look like chiral anomalies, but not really. Chiral anomalies are one loop exact. These anomalies instead, they get a correction to all possible loop orders, okay? So why we care about this quantity, this A and C coefficient of this anomaly of these tensors. So it is shown in a series of theorems and results that they satisfy many constraints that comes from unitarity and many other basic properties that your CFT should have. Okay. So one, for example, is that the C anomaly, which is the one proportional to W squared. It is positive, and one simple reason is that this appears into two-point function of stress energy tensors, so they have to be related to norms of some state, so they have it has essentially to be positive. Now, the A over the ratio of the two quantities, it has been shown in, by Maldacena and Hoffman that they're bounded in all theories that we can imagine. And the bounds, they depend on the number of supercharges that you have in the theory. So as you can see, we have a bound for non-supersymmetric theories, and this goes shrinking as I increase the number of supercharges. Well, obviously, in N equal 4, nothing happens. And more, the most important one, at least in my opinion, is the A quantity. I mean, this quantity is positive by the proof of the above, and it is. We will see why this is a very important quantity actually for these theories. And what we call why we call these local constraints, it means just these constraints knows only about the CFT they're living in. Okay, so I have a CFT, which I don't even have to have an action for it. And these quantities, they're embedded in this theory, and they have to satisfy this thing. They don't know anything about what happens if I flow out of this CFT. Okay, and the importance of the A quantity, of the A anomaly, is that there is a theory that permits you to go out of a CFT, so that can bound what happens actually in the flow. So it has been proven by Komargoski and Swimmer that if you have a flow like the one that I described from a CFT UV to a CFT IR, you always need to have that the A anomaly in the UV is larger than the one in the ER, which pretty much tells you a lot about which flow can happen and from which CFT to which. And there's many stronger statements that are related in this case. So the weak version, which is the one that I just described, is proven beyond perturbation theory, okay? The strong version, instead, is saying that actually you can define a function that goes monotonically from AUV to AIR, okay? And it has been proven in perturbation theory. An even strongest one is that this, this anomaly, this function, satisfies a gradient flow equation, okay? This has been proven by Jack and Osborne in perturbation theory, okay? And the statement that they actually show is that this chi ij acts as a metric in coupling space, and being positive definite happens that this flow is monotonically decreasing, okay? So they translated essentially the theorem in saying, okay, this chi ij has to be positive definite, and they show that at the leading order in perturbation theory, that's the case.
Sorry, what is the second term there?
Sorry?
What is that second term there?
Okay, this second term is some spurious scheme-dependent term that is there because this A tilde function outside of the CFT is not physical. It can change if you use a different randomization scheme. The important thing is that at a fixed point, this is physical, so it has to be scheme independent. And that's exactly what happened because that term is proportional to beta functions. Okay, so in between fixed point doesn't have, is not exactly physical. Okay? And nice. Then, what are the consequences of this theorem? Okay. So if I say to you that this quantity has to decrease along RG flow, and it is, well, I mean, we think that that happens in the strongest version, so monotonically, this could be a quantity that, I mean, is a good candidate for a count, for something that counts degrees of freedom, right? Because in the Wilsonian picture, we know that flowing from the UV to the IR, I integrate out degrees of freedom, I lose stuff. So this quantity seems exactly to satisfy these requirements, okay? So that says that in ultraviolet theory will have more degrees of freedom, okay? Which is nice. This also means that if you think about in a broader context, it means that theory space is foliated. So essentially not all flows are permitted, and there's a hierarchy of possible CFTs. And now is nice to ask where is asymptotic safety? How do I ask if there's asymptotic safety in this context? It's just asking if there's something very up there, right? at the beginning of this flow cascade. So if this A function counts degrees of freedom, is not bounded from above. I can have a free theory with a lot of scalars, a lot of fermions, and that is since is count degrees of freedom, will be very large, okay? So probably what you might also want to ask is that asymptotic safety, can I have a theory up there which is not, which is an interacting one, obviously, okay? So because there's not really an upper bound in there. Okay, so another very nice thing that comes from this gradient flow equation is that they have consequences on flat space, and meaning they have consequences on beta functions.
So, can I just, so when you say it's proved in perturbation theory, yeah. I mean, so Kamagoski-Schwimmer, they didn't really do any perturbation theory when they were talking about this.
The strong version, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, they never actually do any diagrams. Well, you know, they give an example.
But I mean, they give a monotonic function, right? But it's proportional to beta function and...
To the beta function,
and I mean, it's argued that there's some scheme dependence there. It is not very clear. I mean, if I understood correctly, that is a good proposal in perturbation theory, but they I think is not satisfactory beyond for a monotonic. I mean, the argument for the weak A theorem doesn't involve beta functions, right? So that's why I think it could go beyond perturbation theory. But the one the strong has beta function, and yeah, that's essentially perturbation.
So it's perturbation theory in the beta.
Yeah. So yeah. So the strong version is, I mean, I would say that is not proven beyond perturbation theory, but only. Okay. And so, what are these vital consistency conditions? Well, you can imagine this way. So if I have a gradient flow equation, this is very similar to an equation of electromagnetic potential. Electric potential, right? So you know that such equation has the divergence of my potential is equal to the actual field, and I know that I can integrate and obtain the potential only if this field is irrotational, right? And now if I have a gradient flow equation, well, that's pretty similar, okay? Aside from this scheme dependent part, is very similar, and so it means that my beta functions modified by the metric, they have to satisfy a condition of being irrotational in a coupling space, okay? But this is pretty interesting because one can show that this metric actually has dependence on the coupling such that this equation relates different order in loops. So I can, these equations are relating, like example, a one loop coefficient of a Yukawa beta function to a two loop coefficient of Lagrange beta function, okay? So that's why, for example, in some cases, we say that we want to work in a specific order in the looping beta function, which is usually 3 for gauge, 2 for Yukawa, and 1 for quartic, because that's the minimal, next to minimal choice that makes us satisfy this condition, and then to integrate and obtain an A function. Okay. Right. So what is this good for? Okay, why we want to implement these constraints. So we want to study fixed point in general theories, okay? And we want to ask if these fixed points are viable. So do they, if they break these constraints, in perturbation theory we already know that shouldn't be the case because everything is proved in perturbation theory. Okay? But if I go beyond, well, that these constraints could be a test of when perturbation theory is actually valid at that fixed point, okay? So one thing that one can do is just consider the usual gauge Yukawa theories when you find a fixed point within perturbation theory, so maybe I also do large N, large NC, okay? And I can compute all these anomalies. There are formulas, so these are the zeroth order, and you see that, for example, the A is compatible to accounting of degrees of freedom, just with weird weights, okay? C, it is two, but it is shown that doesn't have the same characteristic of A. And one can construct the higher order of A using the gradient flow equation and the knowledge of beta function, okay? So what can you do with this kind of analysis? Well, I'll give you an example, which is much easier to explain, maybe. So like here, I'm considering a theory where you have a scalar and fermion, OK? No Yukawa, because they're all in the fundamental of a gauge group, OK? And the scalars interact with itself with a double trace potential, OK? So this theory can have a fixed point. AR1, you can see from in large NC, large NF, you can have, if you do in Venetiano limit, you find this fixed point. And if you're really perturbative, then all these constraints are automatically satisfied. Okay? They have to be, because it has to be proven. It is proven. Now, let me think, what if I say, OK, I'm in the Venetiano limit, so small epsilon, but I take an F and C, not infinity. Okay, I take it large, but not infinity. So I want to try to see if I can build a phenomenological model with that fixed point. Okay, so this constraint can tell you when you can and when you can't. Okay, so this example is that theory, and you just have a series of fixed points depending on an F and an C. Okay, so each point is actually a fixed point. And I calculated the A over C for all of this. In this case, I focus on this bound, the Maldacena-Hofmann one. So you compute this quantity. This is the zero of the axis is at the lower bound. Okay? So you see that all the theories that lies below, they all away. They do not satisfy the collider bound, okay? Which is one of these constraints that we want to test. So and if you notice, these are the one with like smallest NC, every branch is a different NC, and here you have an F. So the one with a smaller NC and an F, they fail to satisfy it very widely. And as you go to large NC and large NF, instead, they're usually well satisfied. But this gives, for example, some bounds on which finite value you can have for that fixed point. OK, that's an IR fixed point, an example of an application. And let's see instead another example of a safe fixed point. So this is a theory, it's a George Glashow theory. And it has been shown that it is automatically anomaly free. It has a charged X. The interaction are full of Yukawas. And this FA is just a vector in flavor space that tells you which flavor is interacting with the charged Higgs. Okay? Not all of them, they're interacting with that. So that's essentially what they're saying, nothing more. And in this theory, it has been shown that you can have a lot of IR fixed point. It's pretty easy to have it. But you have three cases where you have a UV irrelevant, a UV attractive direction, which are these three. And you can see that from the value of the fixed point, I mean, the first one, OK, you may say is wildly away from perturbation theory. There's a six there, so I should not trust that. The second one, well, that could be maybe, who knows. And the third one, well, still undecided. Well, if you actually calculate these quantities, the A, C, A over C, you will find that you violate a lot of them, okay? So for example, the first one, the A is widely negative, so that's way, way out of it. These are positive, that's fine, but then A over C, is always below the lower bound, is one third. Okay, not, and we don't even talk about the delta A, which is the difference between UV and Gaussian. Okay, so this, for example, gives you if you had a doubt to say, well, okay, these are finite NC, finite NF fixed point that could be safe. Well, this bound says that they're beyond perturbation theory. I mean, you cannot trust this order. Essentially.
So, sorry, can I ask something? So, so how are these calculated?
Okay, so I didn't know if I wanted to put the big the formulas for that, but
just heuristic. They kind of describe it. Is it? Yeah. So what is the calculation? Are you calculating some Feynman diagrams or?
So the zero order result, they've been calculated since a long time, and they use a heat kernel method.
Okay, so this is just
yes.
Is that one loop then this?
It's kind of one loop, okay. But the C function also has a first order correction calculated the same way, but nothing more. The A function, instead, in principle, if you know the metric, this metric and the beta function, okay, you can compute it to the order you want. If you believe the gradient flow equation, you just integrate it, okay? And what we usually do is that we use the up to NN law, okay? Which is the easiest to obtain, essentially.
So basically, so I guess I'm not going to understand the problem with violating those bounds is that if you take this theory and then, I guess, run the RG with it, then you're going to end up somewhere that's very non-perturbative. Is that the statement then?
The statement is that these bounds has to be satisfied, right? So if I fail to satisfy it, since in perturbation theory they have been proven to hold, it means that my fixed point where I'm reaching, I mean, is beyond perturbation theory. I cannot trust this, I don't know, I find a fixed point at two loop.
So you get a strong coupling at some point? Right? Because, I mean, I could start with a small g and y and everything is perturbative to begin with, but then does it mean like there are lambda poles? Would that be the statement?
Oh, well, if you have a lambda pole, you cannot even apply this stuff because you don't have the end point. You don't have the ultraviolet. So, yeah, so you have to have two fixed points.
Right, so that's the thing. What is the alternative? So I guess the thing is, this is a well-defined theory that is perturbatively, and I can run RG with it. Mm-hmm. But then, since you're violating this, the A theorem mm-hmm. conditions, then it means that you have to hit a strong coupling.
Essentially, I say that at that order, I mean, what one could do is say, okay, then I go to three loop and see if the fixed point survives. Then I go to four loop and see what happened. An alternative is, to say that, like at this order, they do not work. You should go to the next one to see what happens, really. Okay. So, but this is the problem in non-supersymmetric theories because, in perturbation theory, everything is mostly satisfied. And, I mean, this is the thing you can say. You can say you're beyond the range of perturbation theory. Okay. And nice. Now let's talk about instead supersymmetry, where you can say a lot more. Okay. And the reason why is that in a supersymmetry, you have an extra thing, an extra symmetry, which is called an R symmetry, which essentially acts non-trivially on the fermionic generators of your algebra. And I will focus on N equal one, where this R symmetry is a U1. So these R symmetries are usually only defined up to other conserved charges. Okay, so if it's not unique, the R charge that you can have in a model, but it's up to other flavor symmetries, for example. However, there is a special one of this R. There's a special one that's the one that that essentially goes into the superconformal algebra. So in the superconformal algebra, if you have also the conformal part other than supersymmetry, you will have that this R enters dramatically, okay? And from the fact that, for example, it commutes with a dilatation symmetry, with a dilatation generator, means that his eigenvalue, they have to be proportional to the scaling dimensions. And you know that scaling dimension of operator for a CFT, they're pretty important, right? And moreover, these R symmetries enters in a supermultiplet together with the stress energy tensor, which controls conformality. Okay, so violation of one implies the violation of the other. Okay, and if R is not anomalous, then also T mu nu is not anomalous, and you have a complete conformal field theory with supersymmetry. Okay, and why this is nice? Well, this is nice because we can ask the question of, does this N equal one Suzy theory has a fixed point from the pure algebraically point of view. The beta function are exactly, for this reason, they come out to be proportional to the anomaly of this R symmetry, and they are known to all order in terms of this R, okay? So a constraint to having a fixed point would mean essentially to constrain these R charges that I assign to every field in my theory, okay? Like superpotential, they're bounded to have, for example, R charges equal to 2, while instead for a gauge beta function, you will have a relation among R charges of the elementary field and their their group theoretic factors, okay? But on the other hand, since the anomaly of this R charge is also proportional to the trace of the stress energy tensor, there has to be a way to express this ANC anomaly in just in terms of R charges. And in fact, there's a complete relation for that. This is beyond perturbation theory. Means that this is not only all order, but also takes into account every non-perturbative contribution you can have. So also is the okay. So how does it work for n equal one then? If I want to study, if I have, for example, safety in an n equal one theory, I'll just count how many R charges I can have. So I have a one R charge for every elementary field in my theory. And I will have one constraint on these R charges for each beta function, right? For each operator that I add to my action. Now, then one can notice that, I mean, if I have more constraints on these R charges than R charges, then I cannot satisfy them. And the only possibility is to have actually only a Gaussian fixed point. If this number is equal instead, I could find a non-trivial fixed point candidate. And that would be a special combination of R charges different from the one that I have in the Gaussian. And if I have less constraints than R charges, there's another way to get around it, which is called A maximization. And you, in principle, you can generate other extra constraints, but I'm not getting into that. Okay, but once essentially then, if I have a fixed point in one of these theory, a putative fixed point, I will have my combination of R charges, and I will use these R charges to apply the constraints on A, C, and A over C. And now these quantities are computed exactly. Okay. So these constraints actually tells you exactly how the flow goes from if it is compatible with a static safety or not. Clarify, here's an example. So in this example, I just have super QCD with two adjoint fields, okay? Two chiral super fields in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. Okay. So what I do is to add two superpotentials, okay? So in this case, then I will have three constraints coming from beta function, one for the NSVZ, so the gauge, and two for each term in the superpotential, okay? And I have exactly three R charges. Two adjoints and one of the chiral superfield in the fundamental. Moreover, I mean, I can get a solution out of this, a solution for these R charges, and if they satisfy the constraints on A, C, and possible unitarity bound, then this could be a good candidate for a fixed point, okay? And calculating delta A, it tells you if this fixed point is ultraviolet or infrared, okay? Now, one example, for various combination of this coefficient, so for various superpotential, and one result that one can find is that, let's say that I start from a Gaussian infrared, I can find interacting ultraviolet, adding some of this superpotential, and this is actually how many possible flows I can find as a function of this x, which is a ratio between nc and nf. So you see that when I have like nf very, very much larger than nc, then I have all channels open, and I have a lot of the superpotential that are compatible with an ultraviolet safe fixed point. While if I diminish this quantity, they just close up, which is it's actually what one expects, because you know that at a certain point you will have the conformal window starting, and you know that an epsilon away from that, you don't have asymptotic safety. And yes, one example is, for example, at x equal 46, which is the lowest amount of flow that you can have. These are the superpotential that can allow for a UV safe fixed point. And these are a graphical representation in unit of delta A. So you actually have six of them that they have the same, if you want, amount of degrees of freedom, and one with lower, okay? So I would like to conclude now saying that, well, these constraints, they can be important in perturbation theory if you want to ask how much can I trust my perturbation theory, how far can I go, like a question would be, where is the lower limit of a conformal window? How much can I lower my number of flavors of color such that I lose conformality? This is one of the questions. But in supersymmetry, what happens is that they're entirely determined what kind of landscape for RG flow you can have, okay? However, in the case of supersymmetry, I have to say that these constraints are a necessary condition for this flow to be there, not sufficient. So it's still not set, if you want, okay? But if you fail to satisfy these constraints, then you're sure that that RG flow cannot happen. Okay, and having said that, as a provocative statement, I also have a question, which is, can I have, for example, these models, I don't not exactly these ones, but someone else that can have a UV safe fixed point, and can I break supersymmetry such that I go back to the standard model from one of these fixed point? And even if the interacting fixed point is not compatible with having the SUSY IR Gaussian, can I still go to a IR non-SUSY Gaussian? That's the thing. And I'd like to conclude with this.
A few questions.
Late. Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the questions about SUSY is that, well, there were two questions. Like, when how you, I mean, not questions, I'm saying things that we would like to understand better. Right? So, one of the things that I still don't know is this example where I can find this are not really proof of this. So you can just say that you can exclude it.
Yeah, you can prove non-existence.
Yeah. So it would be nice to see whether one can generalize the methods, right? I mean, what other constraints one can have? To actually rule out the presence of a fixed point.
Yeah, that would be ideal to find something other than this, but yeah, that's not not super trivial.
No, but for example, in the paper with Steve, the recent paper with Steve, right, through dualities, you start getting actually principle more relations between, you know, you can actually follow the flow, the non-perturbative flow. So if I were a duality of this and we go to a weakly coupled theory, then I can actually follow the flow. And I should be able to see that the dual flow is weakly coupled, and perhaps there is no fixed point.
These are
something that, you know, I don't understand is that if I have a duality, then I can map an A function, perturbative function, to a non-perturbative A function. And the question is, what are the constraints? Because it's enough to say that, that all the constraints are satisfied.
Yeah, that's a good question.
So actually, that's why I asked you about the perturbative issue. Because it's not obvious to me that it's really a perturbative expansion that we're doing when you're doing Kamagoski-Schwimmer. But
You mean, The weak version, you mean? So you're not following the flow, so you're just watching at AUV, AIR, that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, you can still define a flowing A
function. Yeah, right.
And it's not really a perturbative definition. You know? It's just an operational one on the integrating over the cross section.
Yeah, but that's something. In fact, that I didn't have much clear. I mean, is that a proof of beyond perturbation theory of the strong version, not of the gradient flow?
Well, but I think they thought it was at the time, but then it seems to be that it isn't because there are beta squared corrections to that.
Because it wasn't that much highlighted as I would have expected if that was a.
So they didn't really claim it in the paper, and then later on there was a paper by Bochinski and so on pointed out that it isn't.
It isn't.
I think that's the story.
How is this proofs of the strong theorem in perturbation theory. I mean, that's not to all orders in perturbation theory, is it?
It's based on the amplitude of the four dilaton amplitude, but it doesn't ever calculate the amplitude, so they don't use perturbation theory for it.
Okay.
Oh, but you mean of the gradient flow in perturbation theory?
It's like they have the Diagonal form.
Yeah. No, that's proven to leading order, right?
Right, because it's just sometimes said as a proven perturbation theory. But
yeah, proven perturbation theory means that the leading order is true. yeah, and then order by order, I don't. You have to have the hierarchy. I mean, you have to have the leading order to be the biggest one. So that's positive. And
I guess the thing that puzzles me is that if you have a strong coupling somewhere in the middle, like if you have, say, you go from mesons to quarks at some point through strong coupling, then does it even make sense to talk about, say, beta functions? Because you have a different theory.
Yeah.
So then what couplings are we talking about?
But this A function sees that. So this A function, for example, is able to see that.
The beta functions are not.
Yeah, no, I guess not. If you confine and everything. But for example, one of the first applications of this A function is to see that if you have the free QCD in the ultraviolet, that's compatible with having an F squared minus one Goldstone bosons in the infrared if you have chiral symmetry breaking, which are essentially the pion. That was one of the first arguments to say that this should be true.
Another question. Let's see.
Okay.
I have another one. So, what if you have gravity?
So, if I have gravity, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't know what happened. But, I mean, people, for example, calculated the contribution to this function for spin 2 graviton. So, there's number for that. But I'm not sure anymore. I mean, now these anomalies are operatorial anomalies, right? So if you actually quantize the theory in curved background, that's not consistent anymore with gravity. So I don't really know the framework. I'm not very sure. Mm-hmm.
So let's thank Nicolas.